This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation about the week's news at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy there, Colin.
Actually, this week, columnist Chris Powell called me a fixture in public life. So I think I'd like to be referred to that way. It's like I'm a toilet or something.
Now, you are a fixture in public life. I like that. Very utilitarian of you. Welcome once again, Colin. Also here is Susan Bigelow, a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com. Hello there, Susan.
Good morning.
And Russell Blair, who's from the Hartford Courant, has the very all-encompassing title of content editor. Hello there, Russell.
Or content editor, as Colin once pointed out.
He's the content editor.
He's so content.
Let's start by talking about mayors. We spend a lot of time talking about the state capitol, but there are some big races for mayor in the major cities, and not even just the major cities. Hartford Mayor Luke Bronin this week became the latest big city municipal leader who'll have to survive a challenge from within his own party before seeking a new term in the general election. Hartford State Representative Brandon McGee on Monday announced plans to battle Bronin for the Democratic Party nomination. Here's McGee explaining one of his reasons for entering the race.
Potential and possibility lives in every resident here in the city of Hartford. I am running for mayor because I want to create a city that embraces each and every resident and creates the conditions for them to succeed.
So, Colin, a number of challengers stepping forward in Hartford, in New Haven, in Bridgeport. We'll also talk about the city of New Britain, where it's not necessarily a contest between Democrats. What do you see in all these mayor's races off the bat?
Yeah, a few overarching themes. One of them is, okay, so 2018, we know, was a change year. It was actually, for once, maybe not in your best interest to be an incumbent in a lot of these races. Typically, though, it is in your best interest to be an incumbent because of the way that you can raise money, just the basic inertia of just being there and the kinds of other resources and support that you can marshal. I just have a question. I don't have an answer. I mean, it'll be interesting to see whether 2019 is, in mayoral races, a change election. Mayoral elections tend to be, obviously, very, very local. The issues tend to be local. The mayor tends to be somebody that you know and can see while you're out shopping and stuff like that. It gets processed a different way. I don't think people who are mad at Trump or something are going to have that affect their mayoral vote. Having said that, there's another theme here, which is that three of the incumbent mayors sought the governorship in the 2018 cycle. So Aaron Stewart in New Britain, she has, as you said, a slightly different situation there. Luke Bronin in Hartford did it despite having said it was kind of the kind of thing he wouldn't do. And then Joe Gannon did it in New Britain, in Bridgeport, excuse me. And Joe Gannon, of course, has the advantage of having done so many bad things that this, you know, seeking the governorship would probably be kind of low on the list. But I'll just defer to the other panels. I will say, you know, already, I feel like Luke Bronin can't catch a break. You know, he just can't. So on the day that he announced for mayor to his reelection campaign, The Current ran a page one story on the rat problem in Hartford. And you just really kind of don't want that on the day that you're, you know, just like everybody understands what a rat problem is. You can talk about problems in the schools and problems with, you know, the tax base and pilot and stuff like that. And people will go, yeah, I don't really know much about that. Everybody knows what a rat problem.
Everyone knows what a rat problem is, Russell. We were all complaining here that, you know, we all took our commutes into Hartford today and you hit the Hartford streets and that's where the 2 inches of snow still are. These are the things that actually matter. Maybe we'll start there with Luke Bronin and his prospects in Hartford.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that's important to look back at is when Luke Bronin won the mayor's seat 4 years ago, he won the Democratic endorsement away from the incumbent Pedro Segarra. So, you know, it takes something like that sometimes to upset an incumbent mayor, you know, where you come in, you're a newcomer, you win the party endorsement. This time around, I think what we're going to see the campaign framed as, and we sort of saw it with the way Brandon McGee announced he was in front of the apartment building that he grew up in the north end of Hartford. And this is similar to what we saw 4 years ago. I think it's going to be a sort of, you know, I'm a Hartford guy. I grew up here. I understand your problems better than Luke Bronin, who grew up in Greenwich, you know, had a life of privilege. He's coming in from the outside. You know, I'm a guy who knows how to do it better. And one of the things that I also think we'll see discussion on is there's been a lot of development in downtown Hartford with the baseball stadium. There's plans now, again, for development around there that are moving forward. There's been some apartment conversions, things like that. So downtown has seen some growth. But I think a lot of people in the neighborhoods are saying, you know, I'm not seeing that. You know, my city block still looks the same as it did 20 years ago. I'm not seeing a new apartment building come in. I'm not seeing any, you know, commercial properties being redone. So I think that what we're going to see is sort of this narrative maybe of, you know, parts of Hartford are doing well, other parts of Hartford are not doing well. How do we spread the wealth and get some of that money, development, investment out more into the neighborhood? Certainly there are some projects that are going on in the neighborhoods, but I think there's a lot of people that feel like they aren't getting as much attention. I know one high-profile project that Mayor Bronin talked about, you know, during the campaign that now is starting to seemingly move forward is the Park and Main, that big corner where Park Street meets Main Street. It's been vacant for a long time. People have had a lot of different plans there, and I think that's something that Mayor Bronin wants to move forward on to say, look, we're reaching out into the neighborhoods. We're not just focused on downtown. We realize, you know, we want this to be development and projects that help every neighborhood.
Yeah, and for people who don't know the city that well, that intersection, Susan, is a place where a really vibrant stretch of Hartford that has all sorts of stores through the Frog Hollow neighborhood sort of dead ends in a main street that should be one of the most heavily trafficked places in the city, and it's got a bunch of big vacant lots there. To Russell's point, though, I think that there is a question about whether or not the story that Brandon McGee and others are telling about no real investment in the neighborhoods, lots of investment downtown, it's not just Luke Bronin, it's every mayor going back 50 years in Hartford. I mean, nobody ever pays attention to the people who live in the city. People always pay attention to what's happening downtown, and this is nothing new.
No, it's not. And actually, the idea that there is a part of Hartford that's doing well seems like a bit of a break from the past, when even downtown investments seem like they didn't really go anywhere, and Hartford was just nothing but potential, but nothing actually happening. So it's not a bad narrative to say, look, at least there's something happening in Hartford. And I don't know if that's going to help Luke Bronin out in the neighborhoods or not, but he actually did very well in his race in 2015 in reaching out to the neighborhoods. So I don't know if he can do the same thing now, if people really care that he kind of ran for governor and stopped. I'm not sure that that's interesting to people or not, or if they're going to remember it when they go to the voting booth. We'll see.
But I wonder, you brought up this question about whether or not people care about the fact that he ran for governor. Part of the reason he ran for governor is because he has probably stronger ties at the state capitol mm-hmm. than he does within the city of Hartford. And one of the things that Hartford needs is a big B bailout or a little B bailout, an awful lot of help from the state and from the rest of the surrounding towns. And I think a big question remains about whether or not a city insider can get there in forging any sort of relationships with the state house, relationships in the surrounding communities in the way that Luke Bronin could.
I agree. I think that certainly it's going to be very difficult for somebody who doesn't have those relationships. I mean, Brandon McGee is a state representative. He probably does have those at least a little bit. Just being able to get some sort of state money, state bailout, it's always going to be important because there's just not enough of a tax base here in Hartford. New Haven has the same problem. They have Yale, where doesn't pay property taxes. Hartford has the state, doesn't pay property taxes. And there's just not enough real estate, not enough space for them to really get the tax base that they need to fund all the many programs and pensions and everything else that is a problem.
Yeah, I mean, this is a whole other show, but pilot payments in this state are also tragically low, payment in lieu of taxes. But we'll come to that some other day. Okay, so let me just say that once again, I'll try to put a big umbrella up over all these races. One of the things that we're not really talking about so far, we're sort of dancing around the word race, but race is going to be a big issue probably in three of these four cities. You know, in the case of McGee, we should back up and say Hartford, although we don't really have political bosses anymore, Mark DeBell is a pretty powerful guy in Hartford. He's the Democratic town chairman. He's very much the guy who made Luke a viable political entity by sort of walking him through this process, walking him through to these places. Now, there's kind of word on the street that Luke has lost a little bit of the North End. So this would be Hartford's most African-American and Jamaican-American neighborhood. And so the rise of Brandon McGee is probably further confirmation of that. I don't think McGee would run if he didn't think he was going to be able to run strong in those areas. So I would expect that, yeah, in that particular race, I don't know what exactly the relationship between DeBella and Bronin is right now. I would assume it's still a pretty firm alliance. And, you know, he'll do what he can for him. But I would expect that to see. And the other thing I'd say about that race is that the more people who get in, and there already are, I mean, there's Stan McCauley and Stallings from the Board of Education, some other, more people who get in, usually that favors the incumbent, you know, because you're sort of dividing up the challenge vote. I don't know. Hartford's so weird, maybe that's not the case. But if you look at New Haven, so in New Haven you have this sort of a reverse racial dynamic, right? You have an incumbent black mayor and a white challenger from the left. And New Haven is, I would argue, I mean, sort of the political base in New Haven is a whole bunch of different things. The white political base is like really liberal. And I think Elicker will be running to kind of court that and see how much of that he can get going. In Bridgeport, you have a situation where I don't think Bridgeport has ever had anything other than a white mayor, right? I mean, there's never been anybody mayor of Bridgeport who wasn't white, which is weird because like a lot of northeastern cities, it's more and more a city full of people of color. So that's very much, once again, okay, Bridgeport really does have a political boss. Mario Testa is the political boss of Bridgeport. Historically, very few things have happened politically in Bridgeport that Mario Testa did not want to have happen. But these kinds of institutions are also in the process of eroding and transforming. You look around the country and you see Ocasio-Cortez and you see Ayanna Pressley and you realize some of this stuff maybe is not the given that it used to be.
I'm wondering, though, Russell, because all of these cities that we're talking about all have some, I think, well-worn stories of entrenched problems having to do with education, having to do with transparency, in some cases in the past having to do with leadership. And I guess I'm just wondering if we see this being a year of big transformations, it's not really, as Colin said before, something where the national mood might sweep through any particular towns. Mayoral races tend to be about people who they know and they think that they can actually run their city, but there is some sort of a movement here to maybe think about making our cities better and just work better over time.
Yeah, and I think mayoral races are also about the person, you know, the personality, how they're interpreted in the community, and you know, it's hard to find any global theme, you know, throughout these. I think, you know, going back to the Hartford mayor's race, you know, one thing that's going to be kind of interesting is, you know, you could argue that Luke Bronin did a very good job of, speaking of state aid, of securing state aid for Hartford, you know, and that it was kind of a methodical approach. You know, he first talked about, you know, look, we need to work regionally with other communities. He did this kind of town hall tour and tried to get other towns to buy in. That didn't go so well. Then he started talking about, well, gee, maybe we're going to have to file for bankruptcy. And he started that conversation. And I think that got the attention of state lawmakers. He worked with state lawmakers. You mentioned, you know, having close ties to the state capitol. I think that helped there. He used to work in Governor Malloy's office, so he knew people there. And he was able to work with them to get this deal that put Hartford on much firmer footing. So, you know, in terms of, you know, what did he accomplish in his term as he's running for reelection, I think, you know, he can point to that legislation. And certainly it was criticized outside of Hartford, probably by some people inside Hartford, too. But, you know, he has a track record that he can point to. And I think we're going to hear, you know, a lot more about that. And maybe the next 4 years is going to be about, you know, OK, we've stabilized things. What's, you know, what are the next steps? Where do we go from here? And I think, you know, like I said, it's a lot about the personality of the mayor. Do you like him? How does he deal with city residents and those sorts of things?
A last thought on Mayor Susan?
I think going back to Colin's original point about whether or not this is sort of a change election in the cities, I don't feel like it's going to be. I feel like the people who we see running are not political outsiders anymore. We don't see people who are just completely outside the political system. We see people who are state representatives running. We see people who are inside the city running. I think that there's going to be not as much of a sort of break with the past as we've seen before.
I want to move on, and Russell mentioned the great Luke Bronin tour of the region, talking to suburbs about giving help to the city of Hartford. Maybe it didn't go so well. People are always talking in some way or another about regionalization. Martin Looney, the Senate president, is proposing legislation to create a commission that would be tasked with developing new regional consolidation plans for towns with fewer than 40,000 residents. It's a bill that's already being talked about. His proposal isn't going over well with some fellow Democrats, including those from affluent towns, but some people from cities like Torrington's Michelle Cook insist it's an idea that needs to be explored. Here's some of Cook's remarks at a meeting earlier this week.
if regionalism is what we have to do to make education in the state of Connecticut work, then we need to figure out how to make that work. And I know that forcing people to do things is not always the right way to go, but sometimes we have to help people get there because they're not going to get there on their own.
The bill, Colin, would force municipalities with populations less than 40,000 to consolidate with other districts. Boy, this is a really red line for some school districts and for some towns.
Well, one thing you never want to do in Connecticut, and really almost anywhere, certainly not anywhere in the Northeast, is use the word force and schools in the same sentence. If you have a bill to force schools to serve tater tots on days when they're also offering deep sea doodle, you're just going to get, you said force, you know, so you don't want to do that. That's why Looney's bill is probably a little bit better. It's a study. I think the other thing, there's a couple of things that happen. People, they kind of mishear this. So as I understand all of these proposals, I think we're talking about creating regional school districts, not regional schools. So in other words, you know, your little itty-bitty baby ducky preschool is not going to get merged into somebody else's. I think the schools would at least for a while remain intact. But there's so much substructure underpinning all this stuff, starting with real estate. You know, there's just a way in which real estate is sold sometimes based on the school system. If you have some kind of regional school system, what happens to that? People move certain places because they like the schools. As I understand most of the thinking here, this is a little bit more about, you know, sort of back office stuff, right? Like, does it make sense to have all these different dinky little towns buy paper, you know, on their own or whatever? This is, as I understand it, about efficiencies and economy of scale and stuff like that, which all kind of makes sense. And I think, as Russell's about to point out, it would also make sense to do that in lots of other places, other aspects of public life in Connecticut and municipal life in Connecticut. But Connecticut has been resolutely resistant to that, and they're probably going to be most resistant to anything involving their darling children.
Mm. Yeah, I think the one thing that is always missing when, you know, there's been many conversations about regionalism and the point that Connecticut has gotten to is where you have, you know, four towns that have a regional health district that puts on flu clinics, which is great, but that's not the kind of thing that saves you a lot of money. And the things that you need to, you know, look at regionalizing are things like schools, fire departments, police departments, public works departments, the kind of thing where everybody wants their own. They want their own local school superintendent that they can go to and complain about something. They want their own local fire department so they know if something happens that they're going to be there in 3 minutes instead of 6 minutes. But those are the kind of things that, you know, those are the big ticket items. Those are the things that you need to look at combining. And as Colin pointed out, I think, you know, when you say schools and regionalism, everybody assumes you're talking about merging the schools together. But, you know, there are a lot of administrative functions. You know, not all towns have a superintendent, but there's probably more than 100 school superintendents across the state. You know, there's mid-sized towns, you know, that have a superintendent that's doing the same kind of things that other superintendents are doing. Some of these schools have administrators that are working on things like curriculum, you know, budgeting, personnel, human resource type things, purchasing. And those are the kind of things that you would think you could combine those and you're not affecting the student outcome. And I grew up in a small town in Connecticut. Chester is about 4,000 people. So we went to a regional school for junior high school and high school kind of out of necessity. And it turned out fine. You know, we had kids from three different towns. They went to the same school together. We made friends. It was okay. So it's going on in smaller communities. I think that, you know, it's now we're talking about, do we move some of this up to more of the mid-sized communities? And the question is, I think a lot of these communities pride themselves on their schools, you know, your New Canaan's and Ridgefields and places like that, maybe some of the mid-sized towns where, you know, they say the property values are tied to the school. And if we combine with next door and the schools aren't so good, you know, what am I paying for is kind of the question.
Yeah. And that's as you bring up Fairfield County towns, because as Russell just said, Susan, out where I live in the northwest corner, there's regional school districts in the eastern part of the state where there aren't so many people. There's regional school districts. It's stuff that we already do. This is seen by some as an expansion of this idea that has worked well in many places.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, there's regional school districts do work well. I've heard complaints about this. That, oh, no, we're going to make our students have longer bus rides. We're going to not have as much local control. But that already exists. It's the forcing people to do something that I think is sticking with people. Also, I don't want to let people think that this is going to be something that affects children at all. It really doesn't. Russell's absolutely right. The outcomes for children are pretty much exactly the same. Parents, on the other hand, they're the ones who are really flipping out. This is not about kids. This is about parents, and it's about political leaders, and it's about local control, which is something that we really hate to give up. So this is such a good idea. It really should be done. It really should have been done a long time ago. And the threshold for somebody regionalizing – right now, the study, the bill's got it around 40,000 people. There's a lot of towns that are not 40,000 people that could absolutely combine with another town. Like, say, Newington could combine with Wethersfield. That's not terrible. But there's going to be so much resistance to that. But really, we need to be looking at combining larger areas. I would like to see a study about combining the cities and the suburbs, because there's a lot more educational opportunity if you have a single district and you have a lot of transportability within that district. But again, there's so much resistance to
it. Yeah, people are already picking up the pitchforks, Colin, as she says that. And that's the problem, is that's probably the thing that would make the most sense and would have the biggest benefit to the largest number of students. And that also means that it's probably the least likely thing to happen.
Yeah, I mean, it needed to be rolled out really, really carefully so that people understood, so they didn't make the kind of confusion that Russell and Susan are talking about right now. And instead, it wasn't. I would add to that three brand new, newly sworn in members of the General Assembly, all of them from that Ridgefield, New Canaan, blah, 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 Greenwich kind of area, kind of went public with their dissatisfaction and did this sort of to whom it may concern statement about how much they opposed regionalization. This is Alex Bergstein and Will Haskell and Lucy Dahan. And in general, when you're new, I mean, it's fine to oppose something. I would advise them to oppose something somewhat quietly at first. In other words, the first thing you do is you go to Marty Looney and say, you know, I'm not really sure I can support this study thing that you want to do. Like, you don't, like, take out a billboard and say, hey, screw you, Marty, you know, because he actually is the leader of your party in your chamber, at least for two of those three people. So I think they may have a little bit of learning to do. And although Marty Looney is, you know, not a vengeful person, he's a pretty good-natured guy, they might have a little trouble getting a bill brought out here and there.
And yet, is there a new model for this, though, being seen, like with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, sort of publicly opposing things that Nancy Pelosi was doing before she was even sworn in, and finding a lot of traction on social media for that stuff? Is there a new model for this? Is that not necessarily the way things are going to happen in the future?
This whole idea of you don't do it that way. You know, there's an awful lot of new politicians, right, or Russell, who don't really care to think about it that way.
Yeah, no, I mean, Will Haskell, you know, 22 years old, I think, and is clearly not afraid to buck the party leadership. So, you know, we'll see how that plays out in other areas. But I think, you know, maybe the feeling is, you know, this is something that, you know, people in their town are so opposed to, they feel like even if they remain quiet, you know, it's going to seem like, oh, are you even thinking about this? You know, and sometimes maybe there's the feeling this is an idea where I have to speak out and we have to sort of push back. But, you know, this is probably something where you put out a more extreme proposal to get people talking about it, and maybe we come to some incremental step, you know, where there's an incentive and it's not being forced and there's, you know, whatever it is. And one interesting fact on all this is, you know, Governor Ned Lamont, I think in his State of the State address, you know, said we can't subsidize inefficiencies anymore. And again, I think in comments to the Current in the last couple of days, he talked about, you know, there's a tremendous amount of state money that comes to help education. And if we're spending a lot of that state money on duplicative, you know, processes on, you know, a bunch of different HR departments and a bunch of different purchasing departments, you know, is that something that the state should be subsidizing? Should we be helping these school districts? You know, certainly we want to help the classrooms and pay for those sort of things. But is there a, you know, some money that we're leaving on the table for those functions? And you know, it'll be interesting to see, you know, what's the governor's approach on this? You know, does he factor some of this into his budget? Does he have something to say more about this?
It seems like a reasonable question for a new governor to ask. Maybe easier for a new governor to ask than some of the folks who've been leaders at the state capitol for quite some time. That's Russell Blair. He's content editor at the Hartford Current. Susan Bigelow is here. She's a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com. Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show here on Connecticut Public Radio is here as well. When we come back, Connecticut drivers are the worst at paying their tolls on the Mass Pike. More about that coming up right after this break in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join the conversation on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us today is Susan Bigelow, contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com, Russell Blair, content editor for The Hartford Current, and our own Colin McEnroe. Hey, Colin, what's on your show today?
So on my show today, we're actually rerunning a show that we did a little while ago, which we kind of collectively called Space Hubris. It's about sort of, you know, are we going to be as stupid in outer space as we've been here in our stewardship of this planet?
Yes.
But one delay, the answer is probably yes. But one delightful aspect of this, Jonathan Keats, who's a guy we've been working with on a lot of stuff for almost a decade now, he thinks one of our acts of hubris is to assume that that extraterrestrials would hear music the same way we always do this music that we play to them. And he goes, well, you know, what if they don't have ears? What if they don't have ears like ours? Whatever. So he put together this Copernican orchestra that plays. He invented a gravitational cello and, I don't know, like an organ that's made out of dog whistles or something. I don't know. So anyway, there's all of that. And the reason that we're doing that is that tonight I will be at Watkinson School doing a tribute to Elvis Presley, or a conversation about Elvis Presley. I think he's somebody that we think we latently understand, but as we've gotten ready to do this thing, we've discovered a lot of things that we didn't quite understand about it. And we're also having a lot of fun preparing the music for this. When I say we, it's Steve Metcalf and Jim Chapdelaine, who are very well known to listeners to our show, and this amazing singer, LaTanya Farrell, who I had worked with once before and wanted to, particularly because there's so many questions about Elvis appropriating black music and stuff like that. I thought, see, there's at one point you're going to hear, if you come tonight, you're going to hear LaTanya do an Elvis song and then do the same song the way Etta James did it.
Oh.
It's pretty interesting. So I think there might still be tickets.
Oh, good.
Contact Watkinson School. You can call them or go to Watkinson.org, get the number. You might have to call and ask, or just show up with $10 at 7 o'clock tonight. We'd probably let you in.
Yeah. Your sideburns, by the way, are coming in very nicely,
yeah, exactly,
in preparation for the program.
I did put on weight just to do this.
I think it's going to be
– Patricia Arquette did it. I'll do it.
The Connecticut Mirror is reporting the Lamont administration has been researching options to broaden the sales tax base, including by applying it to groceries, prescriptions, and other now exempt items while reducing the 6.35 rate across the board. What it sounds like we're saying here, Susan, is that Ned Lamont floating a little trial balloon about whether or not it would be a good idea to raise some more revenue by taxing groceries.
No, that's not a good idea.
It's not a good idea.
Well, I mean, it's probably going to raise some revenue, but everybody's going to hate it. Everyone's going to complain a lot. Groceries, it's such a fundamental thing. You want to tax things. If you want to raise taxes somewhere, you try to do it where in places that it's not going to hurt too much, especially people who are poor, who are vulnerable, who don't have a lot of money to spend on things. If your grocery bill goes up, you notice it. It hurts if your grocery bill is going up and up and up. Certainly, prices are more expensive every year anyway. So I'm sure this is a great trial balloon, but really I could have told you the answer to this one ahead of time.
But there's one of the arguments is by broadening out the base of the types of things that you tax, maybe getting rid of some of the loopholes, the many, many thousands or however many we have of exemptions for taxes, that it's going to be by and large fair. I think the Lamont administration might also say there's also help coming for lower income people. We want to get the minimum wage raised up a little bit. We want to do more earned income tax credit. Maybe there's something to offset that for the people who really need the grocery money the most.
If they can do that, if they can actually put together something that does offset that and it's really obvious that people actually see a reduction somewhere else as they see the increase in their groceries, maybe that'll go over a little bit better. But other than that, it's going to be really hard to swallow.
I mean, my guess is that they knew this idea was not going to be well received. Dennis House at WFSB, you know, it's a Twitter poll, but he did a Twitter poll. Do you think taxing groceries is a good idea? And it was like 98% of people said no. So I think the Lamont administration, knew that was going to happen. But it starts the conversation, and then maybe it gets lawmakers looking at. I think there's over $2 billion a year of exemptions to the sales tax, and maybe they start looking at, okay, we really don't want to tax groceries, but what are some of the other things that aren't being taxed? And a lot of them are, different kinds of professional services, you know, lawyers and things like that, consulting. There's all kinds of parts of the economy that aren't subject to the sales tax for one reason or another. Maybe it's, was lobbied at the Capitol as part of some legislation or something that had never traditionally been taxed. And it's a way where, if you recall during the campaign, I think Ned Lamont was pretty firm about, he's not going to raise doesn't want to raise the sales tax, doesn't want to raise the state income tax. He's reluctant to dip into the rainy day fund to cover the budget shortfall. So it doesn't leave you with a lot of options. And one that is often talked about is, you know, broadening the sales tax base. And I think, you know, they probably knew they were never going to do the grocery thing, but you put that out there, people are going to reject that, but maybe it starts the conversation about some of these other things that aren't going to be as felt by everybody, you know, across the economy, you know, it, you know, less of an impact on people that don't make as much money in the middle class. So I think this is going to start that conversation of looking at this as, you know, it's a another source of revenue that you can find without raising any particular tax rate.
But Colin, I remember this happening a couple years ago in conversations about, you know, raising professional fees. At the time, this was before, full disclosure here, before my wife had a small business that is a yoga studio. I wasn't thinking much about yoga studio instruction being something that was going to be taxed or not taxed. It didn't really matter to me. Now it matters a little bit more. Dog grooming, I know, came up. There's a whole bunch of these. And maybe we just end up, as Russell says, pushing this off into a bunch of professional services. It's still taxes that people have to pay.
Right. So it's the second largest source of revenue after the income tax. Yeah. No, the welter of exemptions is ridiculous. And it does include things like electrolysis and winter boat storage. And these things happen not because they have any public policy basis, but because somebody got a pretty good lobbyist and rammed it through. It probably wound up in the implementer, which, you know, nobody has any time to look at. And, you know, if there's any fiscal analysis done to begin with, it's completely outdated. And so the argument for going through and cleaning up all that stuff, I think, is powerful. As Russell said, the number on exemptions, and if you want to expand the notion of exemptions, I've said this before, to people who should be paying some kind of tax but they're not for whatever reason, the number gets up to like $5 billion. That's not just sales tax. It's all kinds of stuff. So I think the argument for doing that is certainly there. I think the other part of this is, okay, so this was a little bit of a red flag waved at the bull of the left in Connecticut, who said, what? You're going to tax groceries, but you're not going to tax the billionaires? You're not going to make the billionaires pay more money? So because that's what they want to see. They want to see a much more progressive income tax that goes after, or at least, you know, gets a little bit more out of the high earners. Goes after is probably a term we should avoid. But I think it's also a signal to that sector, too, saying, you know what? We are going to explore pain for everybody. We are going to spread the pain around. We are willing to look at something as basic as a sales tax on groceries, which is a regressive tax, obviously. $100 in taxes on – or the taxes on $100 of grocery is much harder to pay if you're poor than it is if you're rich. You're still buying the same amount of groceries. So it's a regressive tax. Maybe it's a little bit also a way of creating, as Russell suggests, the beginnings of a conversation that says, okay, well, we talked about that, but we're also going to talk about you guys down at the country club.
One of the things that has been floated is the idea that by increasing, well, having any tolls in the state on the roadways will raise money. One of the interesting pieces of information that's come out in just the last week or so is that Connecticut, of all the states that have its drivers drive on other people's roads that actually do have tolls, we're the biggest deadbeats, Susan. Connecticut drivers top the list of those owing money to Massachusetts, about $21 million. Charlie Baker, the governor of Massachusetts, wants some of that money back. Again, understand the way this works. Massachusetts has gone away from the tolls you got to stop at and put some money in or hand money to someone. It's these same overhead stanchions that we're considering here in the state. You either have a transponder that goes ping every time your Easy Pass goes under it, or they take a picture of your license plate and they send you a bill. What we're seeing is Connecticut residents, having had their license plate photographed in Massachusetts, just aren't paying those bills.
Right, and there's no consequence if they don't pay those bills. And Connecticut's the only state that doesn't have like an agreement with Massachusetts or with any other state. I don't know if other states there's agreement there, but there's no agreement in place where, like, if you don't pay your bills for long enough, Connecticut will, like, suspend your license, or they won't allow you to renew your registration. So there's no consequence, because what's Massachusetts going to do? Are they going to send their collectors to your door? Probably not. The people are getting away with this, and there's no consequence. And it makes me feel like, man, I've been paying all my money to Massachusetts because I have my transponder. I feel like kind of a sucker. I should have just been like, nope, I'm just not going to pay it because I can just get off scot-free.
Well, and I think the big question then, Russell, is as we design in the next couple of years a system to collect tolls here in Connecticut, can we reasonably say that we can downwardly project those numbers quite substantially, because we probably won't be able to collect all the money that people are going to owe us?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. And looking at what's going on in Massachusetts as an example of You know, you can have these projections, but if people don't pay, you know, you're not going to get the money. So what does Connecticut do? Do we include in our legislation? Is there talk of an agreement with neighboring states? I imagine we would, you know, if we want an agreement with Massachusetts, we would have to start, you know, agreeing to withhold registration or suspend licenses of people that that don't pay up. And it ties a little bit into something we were talking about before we got on the air about all these different new forms of revenue, whether it's sports betting, whether it's legalized recreational marijuana. Oftentimes you don't hit those lofty targets. And this is just an example of how even if you think you're going to get, you know, I think there was one study in Connecticut that said, you know, $1 billion a year in toll revenue, you might not get there if people aren't, you know, sending in the bills and paying what they owe.
The only thing that I would say about this is that at least if we do something that requires something like an easy pass, at least a lot of other states do have those. I suspect one of the reasons why Connecticut is such a deadbeat is that most drivers here don't have any kind of an easy pass. They all have the thing where you have to take a picture of the plate and send it, and that means that there's a bill generated. Other states, because they have easy pass or whatever they call it, most states people have the transponders already. So it's possible that if we do this and we join up with Easy Pass and something like that, that it'll be a lot easier to collect that money than maybe we think, but who knows?
I think one thing that has been proposed, Colin, is that Connecticut residents in any new toll regime would have to pay less than out-of-state drivers, meaning if you get a Connecticut transponder, you'd pay less on the roads than people from Massachusetts or other place. Maybe we just design a system where it's a really good deal to get a Connecticut Easy Pass. You know, everyone buys a Connecticut Easy Pass no matter where you live on the Eastern Seaboard.
Yeah. I first of all, look, one of the reasons that we don't have extradition here is because we don't have tolls. So why would we participate in any kind of, you know, North American toll organization, or, you know. So once we get tolls, we're going to be part of some kind of compact, right?
Because it's called NATO, by the way. NATO. I just realized that. Yeah. Thank you.
That's where I was going with that. You know, once we have tolls, we're going to have to participate in some kind of compact. And there, at that point, there may be some restrictions on how cozy we can make it for Connecticut drivers as opposed to out-of-state drivers. I mean, I think we're going to become part of an interstate toll system where we may not have quite as free a hand as we suppose. But I'm speculating about that. I have absolutely no idea.
I want to move on, Susan, to something you wrote about bills that we'll see this 2019 session. Some of my favorite things are whenever we look at the, you know, the good bills, the bad bills, and you say some of the weird bills. What are some highlights for you of things coming up the session?
Well, there's a couple of good bills out there that I really do like. There's a couple of bills that are aimed at protections for LGBT people. There's one that would establish a statewide LGBT health network, one that's aimed at safety for trans and gender nonconforming kids in schools, being able to use the bathroom, have bathrooms where they can actually be safe, like single stall bathrooms, that kind of thing. There's also some bad bills out there. There's always bills that are proposed that the people who are proposing them know that they're not going to go anywhere. These are usually Republicans, people who are in the minority, who know that their bills are never going to see the light of day, but they propose them anyway. Like all the millions of bills, there's at least like 50 of these every session to repeal various taxes, like the estate tax and the gift tax and whatever else the tax they can think of. There's also a parental notification abortion bill, which just makes people's constituents happy. It doesn't actually go anywhere. There's a bill that would also require GMO labeling, which there's no science behind that. It's kind of silly, but I can understand why somebody might propose that. There are some wonderfully weird things out there. Like there's a bill that would prohibit the theft of used cooking oil, which this is one of my favorite ones. Apparently this is a thing. Mm-hmm. People are stealing used cooking oil and selling it. Apparently there's a market for this.
How are they stealing it?
I have no idea. Maybe they back a truck up and put the grease in there. I'm not sure. My only knowledge of this is a Simpsons episode where Bart and Homer did exactly the same thing.
From Willie the groundskeeper.
From Willie the groundskeeper.
Holy,
yeah.
Colin, this is a thing? People steal cooking oil?
I'm sort of, unfortunately, a little bit of an expert on this just because in the newsletter I do for Hearst now, I started investigating this. Tammy Zawistowski, who's a state rep from the northern part of Connecticut, is the person who's proposing this. She informs me that the largest amount of used cooking – well, we don't know what the largest one is. She personally is aware of a theft of 450 gallons from the East Windsor Big Y in 2017. A group from Yonkers, New York – it's always those guys in Yonkers – pumped grease into tanks in a white van at about 5:30 in the morning. And the problem is that it's like you don't do much for that. That was a six-degree larceny charge when they caught somebody. So they want to make this a big crime. I'm working – I have a spec script right now for Judd Nelson where we're going to do a big heist movie where he's like an undercover you know, a guy who goes undercover in the used cooking oil.
As part of the Yonkers grease syndicate?
Yeah, exactly. And you know what they do to snitches too, right? I don't got to tell you, right?
Russell, any favorite bills you're looking at?
Well, one thing, what I'm always fascinated by is there's always usually some story behind these bizarre bills. So, in the cooking oil example, it's a legislator who had a problem in her district and heard from a constituent, in this case, the owner of the Big Y, and they go to the Capitol and they say, you know, we need stricter laws about cooking oil theft. So sometimes those little stories are fascinating. One bill that I found recently that I think is kind of interesting is mandating recess in all public schools. And there's a pretty active parents Facebook group about this. And I saw, they just posted a picture today of Doug McCrory is the chairman of the education committee, and it's like, call this guy. He's the guy. We got to call him to get more recess in our schools. So they're very, very active and vocal. I don't know that this will go anywhere. I think a lot of schools probably already have recess. I mean, it's been a while since I've been in elementary school. I don't know how they do it now, but I just thought that was an interesting concept, again, where it's probably parents got in the ear of a legislator.
Sure.
You know, my kid's school stopped doing recess. What can we do about this?
And mandate recess statewide.
There's a couple other bills that clearly have a story behind them. There's one called An Act Establishing a Tax Credit for Meat Processors That Volunteer Their Services for Certain Purposes. Wow. I wonder what somebody
actually dealing with snitches in the cooking oil industry. That's the thing that they volunteer.
There's another one that I like. Apparently, and I learned something with this, there's a measure of beer called a log. And wow. I never knew this before, that apparently you can go – that you can – buy somewhere apparently a log of beer, which is like 1.9, I don't know, liters or something like that. And there's a bill out there that would allow craft breweries to sell a log of beer. So hopefully sometime in the future, you can go into a craft brewery and say, give me a log.
It actually, and it has something to do with the way they distribute it. I mean, there's all these Byzantine rules that have sort of tamped down the craft beer industry. That's an interesting one. Okay, well, take a look at Susan's column in ctnewsjunkie.com because there's a lot more coverage of weird bills. That's Susan Bigelow. Russell Blair's here from the Hartford Current. Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show is here as well. When we come back, officials are considering a name change for Bradley International Airport. That's one of the things that our panelists are maybe griping about this week. We'll come back with some gripes and some feats of strength right after this. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news here with Colin McEnroe, Susan Bigelow, and Russell Blair. Before we get to some feats of strength and some airing of grievances, Colin, interesting story. So much tied up in the Sackler family, which, of course, is the family behind Purdue Pharma. Purdue Pharma is the company that's, in many people's minds, behind the opioid epidemic in America. The Sackler family also is behind millions and millions of dollars worth of charitable donations to all sorts of institutions, art institutions, universities around the country, and also quite a bit of money to politicians, including politicians in Connecticut. The Connecticut Democratic Party got more than $100,000. UConn got about $4.5 million. They say they're not giving any of it back.
Well, one problem with giving money to people and institutions is that they spend it, and then they don't have it anymore to give it back. So, yeah, I mean, very quickly, obviously, the Sackler fortune is built in some pretty unappetizing ways. This is involved kind of creating an apparatus or multiple apparati to push opioids and to encourage doctors to prescribe opioids and to minimize the risks of opioids. So this is all pretty unattractive stuff and stuff that we have now decided – correctly to wrinkle our nose at. The problem is, I mean, there's some interesting philosophical questions too here, you know, greatest good for the greatest amount of people? I mean, do you really achieve something if you take money away from, say, a nonprofit, from an art museum or something that the Sacklers have decided to underwrite? You know, maybe you could put UConn into that category too and say, would anything really be accomplished if UConn did give the money back? I think with politicians, it's less of a philosophical question, more of an optics question. The State Democratic Party, I don't think, has that money anymore. I think they are dangling $5,000. Would you take $5,000 and clean up my record based on that? That's, I think, Nancy Wyman's current offer.
I'm actually going to stop our conversation on that because I want to move to some feats of strength and airing of grievances because we've got some good ones here, Susan. I'll ask you first. Where are you this week? Are you praising something? Are you griping about something?
My feat of strength is that I read through all of the raised bills. There's just so many of them, and so many of them say exactly the same thing. So that was my feat of strength. I am still very tired after that. And that is also my grievance, I think. Stop, guys, please stop proposing the same bill 700 different ways. If you could just talk to each other, that'd be great.
It's nice to know that somebody did read through all those bills. And I know there's other journalists who've been cranking through them. But that is a feat of strength, Susan. Thank you for doing that on our behalf.
Oh, you're welcome.
I appreciate it. Russell, how about you?
I want to give a feat of strength to a cool story I thought we covered the last week. The high school kids in Connecticut that are doing esports competitively. This is something that the state athletic group has sanctioned, and it's, you know, I was kind of an indoor kid growing up, so I can relate to that. And it's a huge growing industry. A lot of people say, oh, they're just playing video games, but, you know, this is something that's billions of dollars. If you go on YouTube, there's a lot of people that do this for a living. You know, they get paid, they have sponsorships, there's tournaments. So I think it's cool that, you know, the Connecticut is saying, look, if high school kids want to do this, if they want to organize a team, and there is a lot of teamwork that goes into this, it's not kids sitting alone in their basement, you know, they're together and they're talking and communicating. And I think it's great that, you know, school districts are sponsoring this, they're having teams, they're having competitions, and they had the first state championship last week.
I will say it's a little bit of a turn. Just not so many years ago, we had a statewide initiative called No Child Left Inside. You know, the whole idea was get kids away from the video games, get them away from their screens, get them out in nature. But the state is acknowledging the fact that people do this stuff inside.
No, I think you can do both, but I think it's great that they're getting some acknowledgement.
Colin, how about you? What do you think about
this? We did a whole show about this, by the way. The colleges now have recruitment programs where they try to get scholarships. They get the stars to come there. So I'm going to do a grievance. I try not to do grievances, but you know, there's. I think when you can't do anything structurally, then the temptation to change names and slogans becomes very attractive. Well, we could do that anyway. And so one of these days, we're going to talk about the fact that a lot of people in state government have turned against the still revolutionary tourist slogan, which I think is a case they need to make before we get rid of it. We spent a lot of money on it. But I'm going to focus instead on the Connecticut Airport Authority, where they are talking about maybe changing the name of Bradley International. They're not committed to it, but they want to be very careful about it because it's well known. But they also think it doesn't really say Hartford or Springfield or any of the things that it's supposed to say. I think it's a perfectly good name. You know, people know what it is. Every baggage handler in America knows what BDL is, you know, and Bradley is like one of the things that actually kind of works. Luke Bronin, I think, was quoted this week or tweeted about how he left his house at, you know, 8:08 and was on a shuttle by 8:38 up in Bradley. Sarah must be driving really fast. But, but you know, Bradley kind of works, you know, and I think it's a fine name. And the poor guy it's named after, I think, is a pilot who crashed. And you don't have to change everything. I mean, it would be amusing for people like us to discuss possible new names. We'll all have a lot of fun if they do that. But, you know, I don't know. Just leave it alone.
But why not think about capitalizing on the fact that it's in Connecticut? When I first moved here, people talked about it being the Hartford-Springfield airport, and I think quite rightly because we're paying for it. It's much more of a Connecticut airport now. Why not try to promote the city of Hartford, for goodness sake?
I guess you can call it Twain Internet. I don't know. Whatever.
I mean, I would just say Providence T.F. Green Airport. Does anyone know who? I mean, I think it's a former politician from Rhode Island. I think there was discussion about maybe changing the name there, too, because it's something that, you know, if you're looking at it on a map and you see Bradley, you know, does it say anything?
It'll be 20 years before people stop calling it Bradley, no matter what they do.
That's exactly right, Susan.
Yeah. I mean, why don't we just call it something great just to get people interested in airports? We could call it the John Cena International Airport. I think that'd be fantastic.
I have a grievance, and I don't love to have grievances. I usually have feats of strength. But I'm going to read the top of a story from a Hartford Current story this week. State Representative Derek Slapp will serve as the new top executive of the Connecticut Technology Council as the statewide business association enters its 25th year. Less than a week ago, the second-term representative from West Hartford also received the Democrats' endorsement as the candidate to replace former state Senator Beth Bye, who has been tapped by Governor Ned Lamont to lead the state office of early childhood. A special election is scheduled on February 26th. What I think we're saying here, Colin, is that someone who just won an election, we've talked about this on the program before, who's already going on to get another election. When I heard that Derek Slapp was getting this big new job, I thought that meant, oh, he's leaving the legislature. No, it means he's getting a very important job in the legislature as he's taking on another bigger job in the legislature.
Yeah, we've said this before, and Kevin Rennie did the second half of his column last Sunday was also about this. I don't think it's asking too much. If you want to run for Senate, run for Senate and serve in the Senate, I don't think that's asking too much. Do what you say you're going to do. That's like a kind of basic thing.
Colin McEnroe, thank you so much. Also, Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com. Russell Blair from the Hartford Current. Thanks to Scott Breedy and Kyan Wolf. Katie Talarski, who helped produce today's show. And this is The Wheelhouse.